Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Our guest today is Jessica Cipetto-Hindman, author of Sounds Like Titanic, a memoir, published in February by Norton. Jessica has performed on PBS, QVC, and at concert halls worldwide. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, McSweeney's, Brevity, and Hippocampus. She teaches creative writing at Northern Kentucky University. Sounds Like Titanic is a book that at first seems as if it's born of the imagination of the author, because so much of it seems unreal, impossible, unbelievable. But once we dive in, the reader rapidly gains an understanding, albeit with a remaining bit of doubt, that we're dealing with true facts, not alternative ones. The book is published at an opportune time. It discusses reality, reality with quotes, and it begins to discuss, whether because it was published a little too early, written a little early, it begins to discuss whatever the hell reality we're living in now. And as a backdrop to our present-day situation, when Donald Trump says that his father grew up in a very nice town in Germany, although it's a fact and everyone knows it, that his father was born in New York City, and Kim Kardashian is studying to be an attorney or an unreasonable facsimile of one. So here, not to wander off as I want to do, we have the composer, a charlatan, a naive, a likable man with the smile of a velociraptor. Velociraptor. And we have Jessica, young, eager to make her way as a kind of good violinist in the world, given an extraordinary opportunity, and the meshing of her talents and the composer's overarching plan together is what gives the excitement and, to be precise, the meaning of this book. And even more, because of the time it takes place in, it gives us a viewpoint from then and then from now back again. And for good or for worse, the book is a gnomon pointing to our times and, in my opinion, the doom that awaits us. So with that peculiar fatalism that I oftentimes introduce in this show, welcome, Jessica, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. So rather than my usually totally off-the-mark initial questions, let me ask you straight up, what prompted this memoir, and why did you think it important enough to write?
Well, when I first started writing Sounds Like Titanic, I thought it might be a shorter article about class and classical music in America. I knew pretty immediately from working with the composer that this was something that would make an amazing story. I mean, it had just all the absurdity of the fake performance. I knew he was an extremely interesting person and would make a great character on the page. But that's kind of, I kind of limited it to questions of, you know, what did this say about the way in which class and intersects with classical music? But as I, kept writing and got more, farther along in the project, I realized that this was much bigger than just one goofy guy and his goofy orchestra. And it was much bigger than just classical music. My experience as this fake violinist was actually, in many ways, a metaphor for other ways in which reality was breaking down in our country at that time.
So there's one spoiler that I can't give away, although one review already has, whether correctly or not, I don't know. But I listened to much of, if they were right, the composer's music along with the accompanying star power, and the velociraptor smile is definitely there when you look at him, with the smell of fear behind it, just as you said. So I guess it may really be him or her, as the article states. So knowing that but not being able to talk to you about it, give us a little background about why you were so excited when you were approached for this gig, if you will.
Sure. I had grown up in a really small town, two really small towns, first in Appalachian, West Virginia, until I was 10, and then in another really small Appalachian town in Western Virginia. And when I was 4 years old, I heard violin music in a cartoon movie, and ever since then had begged my parents for a violin. We lived in a really remote area of West Virginia where there were no violin teachers. But finally, on my eighth birthday, about 4 years, 4 years of begging later, They agreed to get me a violin and violin lessons in Virginia and began taking me 2 hours each way over the mountains for a little 30-minute Suzuki lesson and 2 hours back. So from a young age, I had always wanted to learn how to play the violin. And as I progressed, as I grew up, I got better. I became, you know, a pretty good amateur high school violinist. But by the time I reached college, I realized I was never going to make it in the big leagues. I wasn't someone who was good enough to go to Juilliard or get into a real symphony orchestra or anything like that. So I had essentially given up that dream and moved on to other things. But I was, at the same time, extremely desperate for tuition money for my college tuition. And one day when I was near the in between my junior and senior years of college, I came across this advertisement on a student listserv saying that they were hiring violinists for this orchestra, and the gig was every weekend, and it paid really well. And I was like, oh, man, like, that's strange, because, you know, orchestras don't advertise on student listservs. But I was like, well, I need the money, and I'll just try and see what happens. And I had a friend help me record a demo tape, and I sent in and, you know, kind of forgot about it. But 3 days later, I got someone called me and had me come in. And at that point, I thought, well, you know, they're going to figure me out right away, because I'm really bad at sight reading. You know, there's going to be a disastrous audition, and I'll be sent on my way. And when I got to the office, the woman there was shuffling papers around. I was thinking it was a sight reading music. But what it really was a W-4 tax form, because I'd already been hired. So I had not yet even been interviewed, let alone had an audition. And it just kind of went from there, as, you know, I realized that, you know, there was something, probably some huge mistake in hiring me. But later I realized that the reason I had been hired is because no one was actually going to hear me play the violin.
It's so funny when you go back to your parents driving you, makes me feel like a bad parent. Because, you know, like with my kids, I didn't even want to go on one of those traveling soccer teams, you know, because it's just...
Right.
I can't believe they did that, and, you know, on especially on roads where you could just go off the side and be dead.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was... They're amazing parents. Absolutely. I mean, it was a combination of things. When it was... I really did beg every Christmas, every birthday for a long time. You know, 4 years is a long time in kid years. And so I think, you know, I finally, like, maybe guilted them into, like, doing this for me. They may have thought it would have been short-lived, too. And then, you know, we did those very long trips from West Virginia only for a few years until we moved to Virginia. And then it was a much shorter, like, kind of 45-minute trip after that. But, yeah, those first years, they were absolutely amazing.
And your siblings had to go with you, too.
Yeah.
It must have been a pain.
Yeah, we had to leave so early that I had to leave school 2 hours early. And my brother was in school, so he had to leave with me often. And on the days when both of my parents, or one of my parents was working, you know, they'd have to take the other three kids in the car, right? So it was just like this kind of like... trying to schedule all of that and, you know, have all three kids in the car for like 4 hours at least going over the mountains. It was tough.
Yeah, they deserve some of the royalties, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
So going back to the title, you know, when you, it's really interesting. I own an independent bookstore, so the cover is really cool. But when you look at the title, Sounds Like Titanic, it leaves you like, okay, this is interesting. I wonder what the heck it's about. And so I was in China during the month the Titanic opened. And in Zhangji City, they built a full-size replica of the Titanic. And,
wow.
And it was on every, even though it just came out because it was in China, they had purloined it, and it was on every TV channel and every hotel room I was in. So
right.
Why do you think, I mean, they were obsessed.
Yeah.
Why do you think Americans are so taken? Because I really don't like Celine Dion at all. But why do you think Americans are so taken with that music?
Yeah, and, you know, in the case of the composer, it was not even the real music. It was, like, kind of very similar. It was, like, you know, as close as you can get without copyright infringement to the soundtrack. So I thought about this a lot, and I think that, you know, because when people first came up during the first gig to me and was like, oh, this music, it sounds like Titanic, I wasn't sure... if that was a good thing or a bad thing. And then they'd be like, I love Titanic, and buy like 10 right. CDs. So I was like, you know, that's strange. Like by that point, the movie had been out for like 5 years. And I was just like, why do people want this kind of knockoff of an old movie soundtrack? But what I came to realize is that I think that there was something about the Titanic story in general that really appealed to people in the years immediately following 9/11, which is that, you know, people think of Titanic as maybe a love story or maybe a disaster movie, but in a lot of ways what it's about is this gaining control of the narrative. Like, if you remember, that movie begins not with any of the main characters, but with a fake documentary by the submarine team, you know, and it's quest for the sunken treasure.
Yep.
And then Old Woman Rose is like, no, that's not how, you know, let me tell you the real story. And I think that there was something in the cultural air after 9/11 where people really wanted to feel that you could take control of a national disaster by telling it in your own words. And so the music from that movie just was like really, you know, it kind of comes to a climax at the end where, you know, Old Rose is safe in her bed and she's told the whole story. And I think there was just something about that that was incredibly soothing to people in that time period.
Yeah, and overlaid on that, and especially given your talent, is the idea of, you know, the violin players, you know, playing as the Titanic was sinking, and the courage of that, and then finding him with the violin strapped to his back and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And that to me has always been, if it happened or not, I don't even know. But, yeah.
I think so, from what I read. But yeah, there's so much myth and, you know, fact. It's like, you know, even the Titanic story itself is like very hard to know what is like myth and what is factual.
But it is amazing how it resonates. I mean, on the 100th anniversary, which would have been 2012, my bookstore was inundated. There's like over 100 books that deal with the Titanic disaster, and many of them came out in that anniversary year. But then again, when I looked at what may or may not be the composer's music on YouTube, you know, there's this, not pastoral, it's this patriotic kind of God Bless America, which you call it, you know, going over beautiful canyons and ocean views, and they call it lovely, lilting titles and all that. And that reminds me of when the composer, who's really a nice guy in a lot of ways, you create a really three-dimensional character, you know, when he stays and waits for everybody, and he doesn't leave until the last person comes up and says, you know, your music has changed my life, I lost my son, and this has made such a difference. And it just seems so odd.
Yeah.
But it happened, right? It happened just like that.
Yeah, and I think actually when you start to really think about it, it makes a lot of sense. Like, I think I have some other sections in the book where I talk briefly about how inaccessible the traditional classical music world is for a lot of people. I mean, first, just even starting with my own story of, like, you know, there were no violin teachers. There was no conservatory or something I could have gone to in West Virginia. And I think that's certainly true for most of rural America. And that's just the geographical limitations, right? I mean, then there's like the whole class limitations, right? Where like affording lessons or affording concert tickets. It just the classical music world, for many reasons, is not known for its accessibility. And the composer really, I think, like, part of his success was that he was extremely accessible to people. He not only was his music easy to understand and kind of reminded them of things that they had heard before, but he would stay after every single concert and listen to everyone talk to him, you know, and every kid who was taking lessons, he would, you know, encourage them. And that is just, could not be more different than what you'll see of like the classical superstars, you know, that we, you know, household name sort of classical superstars that we know.
Yeah, like your story about Itzhak Perlman, which is really funny.
Right, and it's nothing against him personally.
I know.
He's like that unusual, and you know, but he wouldn't even stay for the entire concert, right? Let alone like to talk to people afterward. And you know, that's again not knocking him. It's just more to contrast that sort of expectation from what the composer was providing people.
Well, I like the way you talked about it too. Like, you are like little young and meek and mild, and you go, are you going to be playing this? And he just goes, no.
Yeah.
That was really good. So another thing about the three-dimensionality that you create in the composer, and I kind of always want to kind of say the name, I'm not going to, is when he says things like, what is Barcelona? Or who is John Kerry? And he sounds like this savant that is totally like living in this cave or not even interested in what's going on in the world. And I wonder, one, where that came from. And, you know, you kept your journal and you obviously wrote these things down because you found them either amusing or astounding.
Yeah, kind of both. Yeah, I mean, I actually, the most astounding thing, and it's interesting too, with someone like a composer, it's almost like, you know, and you could see in one context that that could be a sign of genius, you know, not knowing, like asking questions like, what is Barcelona? Or he asked, who was John Kerry, just a few days before the 2004 election. And, but, you know, he also, one time when I was in the RV, we were just, you know, on the iPod playing a bunch of different random tunes, I happened to play Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, you know, the most famous work of classical music ever written, the da-da-da-da, and he was kind of just standing there and asked me at some point, I really like this music, what is it? So it wasn't just about the outside world. He had some trouble, you know, with some of the basics that you would expect someone who has sold millions of albums and is a successful composer to know about classical music as well.
And that's what brings me to this, like, you know, okay, is this really what happened? Because, like, one of the reviewers said, how is it possible? You know, he was being sarcastic. He was going, how the heck could this happen? I mean, there's a girl with a penny whistle, and there's a girl playing the violin, and there's this audience. How could they not know this music is playing on a 1495 cassette recorder? And you respond to that. Go ahead and talk about that. Why is it possible that people in a mall or QVC, for that matter?
Yeah, well, one, I'll just say that I took classical lessons, you know, on the violin for 10 years, and it took me hours of looking and then finally playing, but, you know, messing up and realizing that a CD was doing the work for me to even realize that it was fake. So it was a very good optical and aural illusion. When a, you know, human being sees a violinist playing and hears violin music, the human brain thinks that those two things are related. I also think there's a certain sort of psychology to being an audience of any sort of concert, but maybe in particular classical concert, where people just don't want to even consider that it would be fake. In fact, like for my book launch for Sounds Like Titanic, I hired a real violinist to fake along to the Titanic soundtrack, and, you know, kind of as a joke, and like announced it online, you know, it was like, come to my book launch and there'll be a fake violinist. And so everyone knew that she wasn't really playing, that the music that they were hearing was not her, you know, it was not her violin at all. And yet everyone kept applauding and they kept asking, is she really playing? Is she really playing? So, I mean, even in situations where people have been told beforehand, there's just something that we've been just so programmed to applaud and sit nicely and politely while someone is up there with a violin in front of us.
Yeah. And the other thing that was really interesting was when you, like a real, not that you're not a real violinist, but you, like a real violinist, when your string broke, and he was, the only time he ever approached you with some, this incredible anger was at that point. And tell about that, why that happened.
Yeah, so we were, this was at a smaller gig. It was at a mall in Kansas, and we'd been playing all day in front of a Sears, and like hadn't been selling that many CDs. Like, you know, sometimes when we'd be doing this, it would be like dozens of people in front of us listening with rapt expressions on their faces, but this was not one of those times. There was just like no one really paying that much attention. And right in the middle of this kind of 8-hour stretch of a gig, my E string on my violin just broke, as sometimes that happens. And I immediately did the instinctual thing that violinists do, which is I took the violin down off my chin and, you know, looked at the damage, you know, to see, you started unrolling the string. And about a few seconds later, I realized that he had shut off the music and was just kind of storming back to me. And he just was furious. And he never really learned my name in 4 years of working for him. He would always call me Melissa, or more likely he wouldn't call me anything, but if he really had to like come up with a name, for some reason he would just confuse my name with Melissa. And he was just, you know, Melissa, like, never stop playing. You just never stop playing. And he was just really, really angry about that. But it's, you know, of course, in real performances, violinists break their strings all the time. In fact, that can be something that makes a real performance really thrilling. The really famous example of that is, of course, Midori Goto's performance with Leonard Bernstein, where she was a 14-year-old soloist, I think, at Tanglewood, and she broke, you know, she's playing this concerto, she breaks one string, and then she grabs the violin of a concertmaster, and she's this very tiny 14-year-old girl. So the concertmaster's violin is way too big for her, and she keeps on playing without missing a note, breaks another E string, and grabs another violin, and then keeps on playing without missing a note. I think that performance is up on YouTube, and it's absolutely incredible.
What's her name again?
I advise people to watch it.
What's her name again?
Midori Goto. And if you Google Midori Goto with Leonard Bernstein at Tanglewood, it's the famous performance. And what's amazing is just how quickly she grabs these violins, and the whole orchestra stops, and then they just continue on like nothing has happened. It's absolutely incredible. So so that's, you know, an example of a live performance where a string breaks, you know, something goes wrong, and yet the true prodigy is able to just keep on going like nothing happened. And this is, you know, my experience with breaking an E string with a composer was the exact opposite. Like, it completely ruined everything, right? The whole charade was ruined. If, you know, you can't be doing the Milli Violini if your E string is hanging off your violin during the performance.
And that's funny, too, because, you know, when I thought about there is a great deal of metaphysical reflection in this book. Like, it's an analog to the times we're in now, like I intimated in the introduction. But then I used to think back to Milli Vanilli, and I liked them, you know?
Yeah.
They were really good looking. They danced really well. I loved the music. So I was thinking to myself, wait a minute, did I care whether they were lip syncing or not? Did I?
Yeah.
And I don't know whether I cared or not. And it's just like I was talking at the beginning about, although I despise everything that Trump does, and when I wake up in the morning and my first thought is Donald J. Trump is president of the United States, it ruins my entire day. But
right.
Again, another aside, but it's just like, okay, does this really matter if I'm enjoying what I'm seeing? And the corollary of that is, you know, how he always said, we'll talk about it, but he, you know, to smile all the time, just like he smiled all the time. And it reminds me so much of Yanni, and watching Yanni at Red Rocks or Yanni at the Acropolis. And it's just that same thing. And I don't like that at all. It seems so self-indulgent to me. But this
is so interesting. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I know. Do you find any comparisons between the two? I do.
You know, I was saying that's so interesting because I've never really watched Yanni. Like, I'm barely familiar with his music, and I haven't watched like the live videos. So I'm now wondering if the composer got the idea of smiling from that. It's very possible he did.
Well, now
I was always just like,
now you have to go to YouTube and watch a Yanni concert.
Okay, I will.
Watch the one at the Acropolis, because once again, it's like you have this movie background, you know, to it, and that's what makes it, pumps it up.
But
in any event, the other thing that's really funny is, I don't know why you did this, but sometimes, you know, you had to play sometimes like 8 hours straight, and you always seem to be wearing the most inappropriate clothing as possible for you're standing there, like woolen suits and things like that.
Yeah.
I don't know how you did it. I mean, you don't know how you did it.
Yeah, I mean, it helped that I was much younger, that I don't know if I could physically do it now. It was, I think, this is one of the more bizarre parts of the gig, and it was one of the reasons where I felt comfortable writing this story, honestly, because I feel like in any sort of like exploitative work environment, the worker has the right to write the story of what the boss is having you do for the money that you need. And this was certainly one of the more exploitative parts of the job, is that during those craft fair and mall gigs, we would play anywhere between 6 to 10 hours at a time with, like, you know, every 2 hours we take like a 15-minute break. And then sometime in the middle of the day, we take like a 30-minute lunch break. But for the rest of the time, you're just, the CD is on repeat and just looping and looping and looping and looping. And even though no one can hear you playing, we were really playing. So, like, you know, this is not hard for like maybe an hour or so, but after 8 hours, I mean, like, it was a physical challenge. I think in the book, I compare it to like trying to dribble a basketball for 8 to 10 hours. Like, at first you're like, oh, that's not hard. But then after like hour four, like, it becomes extremely hard. And it just, all parts of you start to kind of break down pretty quickly under the strain of that. And then, you know, when we played outside, there would be the weather, of course, too. It'd be freezing or be really hot. And the outfit that you wore in the morning that was fine would be, like, roasting you by the end of the day or vice versa. So.
Yeah, when you're dribbling a basketball, it's just a physical act, too. You guys were doing the physical act, and you actually were playing, although as softly as possible. So you had both, both the mental and the physical labor involved. Yeah, that was really. Oh yeah, and then we can go into your psychological and emotional problems, coupled, like when you're playing in his orchestra, so to speak, and you have to pee, and you really have to pee. And I've been in this situation too. We really, 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 really have to pee, but then when you go to pee, you don't have to pee at all.
Right.
Which was also funny.
Yeah, it turns out what that is a atypical presentation of a panic attack. And I've had actually people write to me since the book came out and some articles I've written about it, saying like, oh my God, you know, I've been suffering from this for years and like had no idea what it was. And I didn't know what it was either. I mean, you know, at first I went to like doctors being like, there must be something wrong with my bladder or something, right? But it turns out it wasn't just a feeling that I had to pee and then not having to pee. It was also, I would think I was going to throw up. I would also have these delusions that, like, my legs were going to break on stage or that the stage lighting was going to fall on top of me and electrocute me. Just, like, you know, kind of absurd delusions, but that felt extremely real. Like, you're completely physically convinced that these things are about to happen. And one of the reasons I decided to write about that in the book is because, you know, any sort of mental illness like that, where you're under the delusion that something's going to happen that is obviously not going to happen, is another way of talking about how, like, reality is breaking apart from itself, right? Like, this inability to tell what is real from what is fake. I started to feel that in my body in a very visceral way, to the point where I was, you know, pretty debilitated by it for years.
Yeah, it sounds like it. The other thing I was interested in was how you had the time, I guess, and economically, how you had the time to do things like go off to Cairo and look for a job, you know, at length. How did you take the time? How did you do that? How were you able to do that?
Well, the first time I went to Cairo was part of a study abroad program, so it was really just regular, you know, the same way that I'd always pay my tuition paid for that trip. And then, like, they, you know, like, always, in fact, Cairo was, I spent a lot less money that semester because Cairo was a really cheap place to live. So after the tuition was paid for, it was much cheaper to live in Cairo than in New York City. The second time I went to Cairo was for a few weeks over winter break, and it was all the money I'd saved from working with a composer. I got a really cheap flight that actually took me through Jordan and stayed with a friend from my Middle Eastern Studies program there. And but Cairo is extraordinarily cheap. So in a lot of ways, once I got there, my cost of living was a lot less than what it was in New York City.
Yeah, I just actually got back from Cairo and I couldn't believe it was the least expensive city I'd ever been in.
Yeah. And also, when I was there, I was obviously there during 9/11, and it was already cheap when we got there. And then after 9/11, their currency collapsed because a huge amount of the Egyptian economy is based on tourism. And obviously, after 9/11, you know, their tourism was, you know, destroyed. So I think when we got there, the Egyptian pound was like four pounds to a dollar, and by the time we left, it was eight pounds to a dollar. So it had devalued by half in the time we were there. So it was very bad for Egyptians, but for an American there, I mean, I remember I was spending something like 14 to 30 cents a day on, like, food, unless we went out. So that's just absurdly cheap. You know, so it ended up being much cheaper than like my usual semesters in New York City.
And I remember taking cab rides there that were like 30 minutes and that would be the fare would be $2 and I'd give them more and they'd almost be offended, you know. I loved it. It was a very interesting place. But back to the book, because we're trying to sell the book. So stepping back, and this goes to that one reviewer who kind of like poo-pooed the idea that this could actually happen. But stepping back and having perspective, do you think of yourself as a reliable narrator? If you can.
Oh, that's a really great question. I mean, I think so. Memoir as a genre is subjective. I'm not a newspaper reporter. You know, this is, it's not the same as like if I was writing for the New York Times or something. That said, I mean, I think that the contract with the reader is absolutely that I've done my very best to tell the truest story that I could. And that did mean relying on, you know, evidence, like going back and reviewing, of course, the footage of like the PBS specials, talking to other musicians. My journal was a huge, you know, help in like, being like, did this really happen? Oh, yep, there it is. Like 15 years ago, me writing about it, right? And emails, some of which I include word for word in the book. You know, so just kind of relying on those primary sources, just like any sort of researcher would do. But then, like, of course, it's being all filtered through my own perceptions and experiences. And which is why I include a note at the beginning of the book that, like, this is not the, you know, the God's truth on this story. You know, like, other musicians may have had other experiences. I mean, the composer was doing this way before I started working with him, and he did it way afterwards. So I obviously can't speak to what happened before or after. I can't even speak necessarily about what happened at the gigs that I was not at, right? I try to make that very, very clear from the get-go. And I also, it's part of why I decided not to name him is because I didn't think that this was really the point. Like, in an investigative article, you would name him and be like, here's this evidence and here's that. And I had the evidence, but I just didn't think that, like, you know, that was really the point. The point was, like, how the broader kind of themes of, like, the societal breakdown between what is real and not real. And then, of course, my own individual breakdown of what was real, not real, with my panic attacks.
Right.
Yeah,
and so it's funny, though, but, and again, going to who he really is, when I watch them on YouTube, it's just that first of all, yes, the smile gives it away, because the smile is this strange, fearful, fervent, reptilian smile, and so it has to be him. But then I see him playing the piano, and I see all these musicians, and I'm looking at it, and it looks like, well, yeah, this is really real. And then I don't know. Then I don't know whether it is or not, and I still don't, really.
Well, I mean, I guess it would depend on exactly which recording you're looking at. But, like, for instance, the program I call the God Bless America tour in the book, I know for sure was overlaid by the CD for several reasons. One, because we had, when we were doing that filming special at PBS, during the taping, one of the PBS sound techs ran onto the stage and started yelling, I'm not getting anything, I'm not getting anything. And, you know, everyone knew I wasn't getting anything. I mean, I never knew what they actually told PBS, but I do know for sure that the Russian violinist in the book I call Yevgeny, he was also the editor of that PBS special. So he's the one who overlaid the CD onto the video footage. And, you know, I was really close with him during the time when I worked for the composer. And then Yevgeny quit, and I didn't really talk to him. And that was like in 2004, 2005, probably was the last time I ever talked to him, until last summer when I was about to publish the book and reprint an email, I'm quitting the orchestra email. And Norton was, you know, the lawyers are like, you have to get permission to reprint this email. So I had to find him first and look him up and send him this, you know, one of those emails where like, oh, hi, you know, remember me? I knew you from 15 years ago. Also, I wrote a book. Also, you're in it. Also, could you sign this legal form saying, like, you know, that I could use your words? And of course, he wisely asked before he did that if he could read the book first. And so I sent it to him. And I really didn't know what to expect because, again, I had not spoken to him for 15 years. I didn't consult him during any of the writing of this, you know, and just did not know what he would think. And he wrote back about 5 hours later saying he had, like, read the entire book in one sitting and loved it, and everything was exactly as he remembered, and, you know, that I had, you know, brought up these memories that he had forgotten about, and that, you know, and that it was, you know, just as true as he remembered it, too. So that was a huge relief, you know, like, to say the least, like, and just extremely validating that, you know, I had really been as careful as I could be in not exaggerating, you know, especially parts having to do with other people, right? I feel like the story is so absurd, it doesn't need any embellishment, like, in a lot of ways from me. It was just kind of like, this is what happened.
Isn't it hard calling up someone from a long time ago, and, you know, they think you're calling up to say, hey, how you doing? It's been a long time. And you have to, and basically you're calling them up to simply ask a favor. It's just like, I always get nervous when I'm doing that, you know. You know,
yeah.
And they sometimes, or I'll do it when someone calls me like that. You know, couldn't you have called me earlier and said, hey, you want to go to lunch or something like that?
Right. But I mean, at this point, you know, I haven't lived in New York for almost 10 years now. I didn't know where he was, if he had moved back to Russia or, you know, I didn't even have, I think I tried to call him, but I don't even think I have his, like, current number. So I had to just kind of, like, do an internet sleuthing expedition to try to find his email and then kind of reach out to him. I had, like, 3 or 4 guesses for the email and sent them to, like, all the email addresses trying to get, it was one of those things where you just really have lost track of someone. He wasn't on social media. Like, I just couldn't find him at first.
Also, it doesn't hurt that I feel he's kind of like the hero of the story in a lot of ways. You know, he kind of took a stand and kind of made it clear that, you know, I've just had enough and I can't, my conscience, my honesty won't let me do this anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. I think he's definitely, you know, a hero of the book as well. And interestingly, you know, I just found out that the first kind of foreign translation rights have been sold for the book, and the first country that wants it is Russia.
Oh, that's
and
so cool.
I wonder, yeah, and I wonder if that is because a Russian is one of the great heroes of the book.
That is so funny. It's, and I guess, like, in closing out, the thing that hits me, and I don't even know if you meant to do it this way. That's why I said that in the introduction. It's like, what hits me is like, well, first of all, this could be a great show. They could probably will get picked up, and maybe Netflix or someone will make it into a series or something. But it's like it would be like a reality show, and the word reality has been morphed. It's turned into something that I don't know what it is anymore. And I think that's my problem with predicting what will happen in this country, because I don't think that reality, what really is real, makes that much difference to people anymore. And I think the backstory of your book is it's almost an allegory of that.
Well, thank you. I mean, yeah, I finished the book in 2013. And I thought at the time that it was going to be more of a period piece, like it was going to be about those years immediately following 9/11 and how reality really broke down. So I had no idea that actually I was very wrong on that. You know, it was actually much more relevant than I realized when I finished.
Yeah.
And as we were editing and shopping the book out for publication, it suddenly occurred that, oh, no, this was just an opening kind of prelude to something much bigger in terms of how our reality was going to break down. I mean, when I finished it, no one was yelling fake news at one another.
No,
and,
it's, you were,
yeah,
it was just like, that's
now
why
that's
I want,
just kind of an everyday sort of occurrence, is people accusing each other of not living in reality or speaking reality.
Well, on that positive note, I almost said thanks, Melissa. Thanks so much, Jessica, for joining us today. It's a great book. And by the way, I own an independent bookstore. It is on the front shelf and the front table.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And if you ever get around our area, please give us a call and come by and sign, or just chat or have coffee or Skype in if you want to our book clubs, because it'll definitely be a book club book.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I'd love that.
Okay. Thanks again so much.
All right. Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
So that was Jessica Cipetto Hindeman. Maybe it's Hindeman, I think. Sounds like Titanic, a memoir. Fascinating work. And I could tell you who the composer is that she's talking about, but I won't, because you can read the reviews and find out. But it's amazing when you look at them on YouTube that it's exactly the way she describes them. Anyway, it's well worth reading, and then you can figure out who it is. It's fascinating, especially the movie stars that he hangs out with. So, in any event, that's that. We have, let's see, Lucasta Miller coming up, who's going to talk about L.E.L., which is Letitia Elizabeth Landon, who was a poet in the pre-Victorian age, just after Byron. And then we have Moali Serpelli, who's going to share her highly anticipated debut, The Old Drift. And we got a bunch more coming as well, because Rebecca has done a good job filling up the spring and the early summer. So as always, thanks for being here today for what I thought was a great interview, and look forward to seeing you next week, having you here next week on The Avid Reader.